When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left for Damien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. Awesome. So, John, thank you so much for sitting here doing this. I've got actually my list of questions.
Oh, okay.
I actually was going to write down a lot more questions, but then I thought, I really don't know where to start because I've got so many questions I want to talk to you about. Because, as I told you before, you're the first person I've ever had on this podcast that I've never met that I've been a big fan of for a long time. Like, a lot of people I've run into, but we've never met, really.
Well, it's nice to meet you.
It was nice to meet you, too. It's been awesome so far. But you've checked out a couple episodes, so I think you know a little bit of how this works.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is all about you. And I guess we're going to start off with how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you heard it?
Probably not. No, forgive me, I gotta apologize in advance. I don't have a very good memory.
No problem.
I didn't listen to a lot of rock and roll when I was a kid. I was three or four children. I have an older sister, an older brother, and I have a younger sister. And my older siblings, they had some records. So there were records in the house when we were growing up. I grew up in Hanover, Hampshire, a small town in New England. And there were some records around in the house, but it wasn't, neither of my older siblings were really big music fans. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I think my father started watching Saturday Night Live right when it started.
Yeah.
So I remember at one point, I can kind of have a vague memory of that, there was some talk about this program at the dinner table. You know, this would be 75, I'd be 10 years old. And so I think that when my dad would talk about this strange program and the fake ads and everything, and there would be also be some talk about the odd musical guests, because mm-hmm. at the time I think Saturday Night Live was a bit more adventurous as far as the acts that they would book, the musical acts. In that first few years, I don't know exactly who was on Saturday Night Live, but I think there were a few kind of...
Costello, I guess.
That was the infamous one, but I mean, I think there was...
Fear.
Yeah. That was a bit later. But I think the Sex Pistols were going to be on.
Yeah,
I don't know.
They were booked for, they never played.
And then
New
it
York,
didn't
right?
happen.
Yeah.
And there was some, I remember hearing talk about that. So I was heard something about the Sex Pistols, never actually heard the music until many, many years later. I didn't listen to much rock and roll when I was a kid. When I got to be 16 or 17, then I started getting into music. And the stuff that I kind of got into at first was what they called New Wave.
Yeah.
Bands like Devo, the B-52s.
So where were you hearing this stuff by this point? Like radio, I guess? Or
no, I mean, there was a local, Hanover, Hampshire was a college town.
Yeah.
Dartmouth College is there. My father taught at the college. There was a college radio station. It wasn't the most adventurous thing, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, we'd listen to it in the car.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty straight ahead. I think there was an AM and FM station at the college. But it was par for the course, 70s rock, FM rock radio. At some point, we started hearing about these kind of different bands. It was friends would tell you about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the main thing. Somebody would come home from visiting an older brother or sister at college and say, "Oh, I got this record." There's no cable TV,
yeah.
Certainly no internet, no compact discs. They're in this town. There was a block or two blocks Main Street. There was a bookstore which had a kind of a decent record section down in the basement, so you could find some things there, you know, and they could order stuff for you. You just would hear about things, mm-hmm. and people would talk about stuff.
Were you reading rock magazines?
Not at all. No. When I was always into visual arts. I loved to draw. I loved to, you know, make things. And when I was in high school, I won some kind of art prize. And the prize was, and I don't know if this is what I asked for, but it was what I got. It was a subscription to heavy metal
magazine. Okay, yeah, yeah.
And at this is 82.
Yeah, progressive art prize for a kid. Like, yeah.
Well, I was a junior or something. Okay. Junior or senior.
But even then.
No, junior, like, in high school, maybe.
There's nudity.
Yeah. Still kind of groovy liberal times, yeah. You know, and stuff. And the art teacher, I spent a lot of time in the art room at my high school. And my junior year, there was somebody who was filling in for the regular art teacher. Both teachers were nice guys, but this other guy was a little more kind of hip in some ways, I guess. And so he, for this art contest, this prize, I got a subscription to Heavy Metal magazine, a year subscription. And Heavy Metal in 82 had a music column, you know. And so reading this, I learned about some other stuff, like The Residents. And there were a couple guys who would write, I think Lou Stathis was one guy, and the other one was Matt Howarth.
Lou Stathis, that name's, he went on to do other stuff too,
right? He
did,
yeah, and I don't think he's alive anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and also, it wasn't just that they had comics, they had stuff about music, they also had stuff about, you know, movies and stuff. Mm. You know, and this was, it was the 80s, you know, and things, it all seemed kind of like everything was going to end in any minute. You know, it was like, well, it's going to be 84 soon, and we have Reagan, and, you know, but there was all this stuff. It was a confusing time for me. I think I was a very confused teenager anyway, but Heavy Metal magazine was a way I found out about some music. And at some point, I think that there was a radio program I would listen to. It was on Saturday night, or it was on, you know, one night of the week at midnight or something. And I can't remember what station it was from. You know, I started buying records. I had a cassette deck. I began to make cassettes and things. For a brief period, there was a girl who was in my high school who came over from England. And so she came over knowing about things, all sorts of stuff. And it was a kind of a weird, eclectic mix of bands and music she was into. Some of it was quite poppy. Some of it was pretty out there. Like I found about Deutsche Amerikaner Freundschaft, DAF, through her. I think she was reading The Enemy. So there were some things which were like, oh, I saw this on Top of the Pops and it was brilliant, and then there was some stuff which was totally underground. So you know, you just, things kind of would filter through. At my last year in high school, cable television came to the Upper Valley, and so we got cable at my house, cable TV. It was like, it was four channels or four extra channels from the whatever you could get out of the air. But one of them was, there was MTV, and at the time, MTV showed some more adventurous stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there was no programming available.
And New Wave was really early on that video. Like, they were the genre that emerged with the video.
Yeah, I mean, and there were people like The Residents and Devo had been making films, and they were ahead of the game, and so they got a lot of access early on. It seemed to be more, you know, things were kind of wide open and just sort of forming. In addition to that, but then there was also a lot of just terrible, you know, it was MTV. In addition to that, though, there was the USA Network, which had a program called Night Flight.
Okay.
And Night Flight ran, I think it was Friday and Saturday nights from maybe 11 or 11:30 until 4 a.m. It ran for several hours late at night, and they would show music videos, they would show concert films, they would show kind of B-movies, you know, things. They would show things like, you know, Reefer Madness or old Driver's Ed films. Then they would also show, you know, I don't know if they showed Mad Max or something, but they would show, you know,
It's like almost like a free-form college radio type vibe.
And the rock journalist Lisa Robinson was involved in it in some way. And I didn't know who she was. I wasn't reading Cream magazine.
Yeah.
But she would do a lot of the voiceovers, and I think occasionally she would be on camera interviewing musicians. But that was another way where I found out about, you know, you start to feel like, what is this? Who is this band? And they even had a segment on there, I think it was called New Wave Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have, you'd have to look it up.
Didn't Sonic Youth play on New Wave Theater?
Maybe.
There was a guy with a sack? No. I'm confused. No, New Wave Theater, I think that's the one the Angry Simones maybe played on or something. Yeah,
but
that.
So there was, you know, you had, and it wasn't just all New York City stuff, they had some LA stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, you could catch, like, you know, an LA punk band or something.
Yeah.
And it's all just like.
So you're just putting together.
Nobody knows. You know, this is, again, a small New England town. We didn't know anything. I didn't know anything. I was, you know, and so you're just kind of, like, grasping at straws and trying to figure stuff out. And then I just began to. You know, buy more records. But back in those days, it was really, the big thing was people that would hip you to something.
Yeah.
Say like, oh, you got to check this out. You know, like an example was this friend of mine who went away, she went to Boston or something. I don't know, she was visiting a family member or I don't know what, but she came back and she had a copy of the Fire Low by the Gun Club.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a mix of some really great, you know, things which have stuck with me, you know, really great classic underground, whatever you want to call it, punk, underground, American indie records and bands, people such as the Gun Club, and then this kind of odd, you know, major label, new wave stuff. And new wave was such a weird, you know, term, and it was strictly a marketing ploy, I believe, you know. But it, you know, it was this weird grab bag of stuff.
It's like UGA Music War. It's like basically that soundtrack to that is New Wave.
But I mean, New Wave was odd, but also the kind of stuff that I was kind of sifting through.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so I don't really have a good, you know, light bulb moment or a really great story about like, oh, I remember when I first heard punk.
No, but I think that's also like part of it is just that idea of like, you know, you don't really come out fully formed, you like put together the pieces.
And I was certainly not, you know, and this was a thing which I've always not really struggled with, but I can't, you know, there are some people who are my friends or people I know or work with peers who will, you know, who are, you know, independent musicians or underground or punk rockers, mm-hmm. you know, and they come from such a, you know, a background of real rock music, mm-hmm. you know, and grew up listening to, you know, every ZZ Top and Aerosmith and this and Sabbath and everything. And I wasn't interested in any of that stuff. I found it just terrible, you know, just incredibly boring. The stuff that was on the radio when I was a kid just held no pull for me.
Mm-hmm. So it was like, it wasn't till you kind of found this stuff that you really got into music, that was your awakening?
Yeah, and I think it was also, you know, adolescence and, you know, I was a late bloomer and, you know, I think things kind of converged. So maybe because I came to listening to rock and roll so late, that's why it stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, you know, once I left high school and then went to college for a little while, you know, that's all I was doing. I was, you know, going to see bands, listening to records, reading about bands, and, you know, it was a much more, and playing music and playing in bands, became a much more, you know, all-consuming thing.
Were there any local bands when you were in New England that you saw? Like not the that Queers, I guess, were done by that point.
What's that?
The Queers, I guess, were done.
Not that I was aware of.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a very straight kid.
Yeah.
A very, you know, good student. Like I said, I was very into the visual arts, and I was a very creative person and stuff. And you know, I if there was, I wasn't aware of it. It was like, you know, you might as well be talking about like, oh, who are the hip bands in China? You know, it was just it wasn't available. It didn't fit into the scope of anything that was possible, at least for my head.
So then you go away to school for a couple of years, and at that point, were you seeing bands that like? Well, did you watch the first show I went, you saw?
I don't. I'm sorry.
No. Don't.
You know, and where I grew up, the college would occasionally bring in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they had a hockey arena. You know, there was a sports arena, so you know, you'd have, I don't fucking know, like Loggins and Messina would come play.
Yeah.
They, with the college, would put on a few concerts every year. There, you know, it wasn't like it's you know, cut off from everything completely. And Boston is only 2 hours away. Montreal is 2 hours away. But I was not going to see shows. When I went to college in Providence, Rhode Island for a couple of years, and then I started to go see shows that there were a couple kind of local rock and roll places that are, you know, punk, you know, they didn't call them punk clubs, but yeah. There was the Living Room and there was Lupo's, and Lupo's is still around, Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel. Back then it was in a different location and much smaller. I think it's still around. But so I used to go see bands, and you go see X, go see Black Flag, go see the Gun Club, and go see even, you know, there was a band, I don't know if they're from Providence or Boston, I think they're called Rash of Stabbings.
Okay.
I went to see the Neighborhoods, I think it was a Boston band.
Yeah.
I don't know. Gerard was probably.
They're the power poppy band, Neighborhoods?
Kind of
power
punky. Yeah. You know, and then there'd be kind of like new wavy synth stuff, like there was a band in Boston called November Group.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, and then you'd have, like, all right, Echo and the Bunnymen would come over, or The Fall would come. And if they didn't play Providence, they would play Boston. They'd play at the Channel, or the Rat, or something.
Were you traveling to shows by this point?
I started to, yeah. You know. And so going to see more and more shows and, you know, hanging out with people. And then also there, then I started to see hardcore. Yeah. And the hardcore was not really my bag, but it was the real eye-opener where that was a light going off. Oh, I could play in a band, or, you know, I could put out a record, you know. So that was sort of the go ahead, the green light, you know, and that was the very important for me. And it was also then being at school. I went to Brown and for a couple of years, and so there was Brown and RISD, and they're right on that hill there in Providence. And so hanging out with people from both schools. And, you know, hanging out with people like, oh, some, you know, my new friend grew up in Jersey, and he's been going to hardcore matinees for the
forever,
past three, 4 years. So you heard more and more, and you got it turned on to more and more stuff. And so, yeah, it just started to grow, snowball.
Because what you do, like, a few years later is so sonically different than I think a lot of stuff happening at this point. Were there any bands that were grabbing you that you were seeing? Like, obviously, the Gun Club and Black Flag. I'm sure. Yeah, I've read that. Obviously, you talk about them before.
Yeah. The bands that were making the biggest impression on me were people like, Swans, yeah. Sonic Youth, Einsters and Neubauten. Stuff like that, I think.
Were you seeing any of that stuff? Or, like, was that... I
saw all those bands.
But they would have been touring by that point?
Yeah, and then there was, you know, New York City was 4 hours away. That's right. I used to go down every once in a while in New York City to see... Started going down to see shows. At the time, I was making films. I would sometimes go down to show these films. And I don't know if I discovered it by accident or somebody told me. I found out where the Swans practiced in the East Village. And I used to just sit outside of that... it was a ground floor place. It was Avenue B and 6th Street, and would just sit there and listen.
Wow.
So
then I guess you moved to D.C.
Julie K. So when I was at Brown, I met Julie Kafritz, and I didn't like going to college. I didn't like Brown University.
Is that when you cut? Sorry, not to cut you off, because you said you were like, you know, like this, like, kid that did well in school, and then obviously in Pussy Galore, you're pretty dark.
Yeah.
Different place.
When
did that shift happen?
I don't, or? You know, chemicals, adolescence,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I was not ready for, I was very immature, you know, I was bright, but I wasn't really ready for real life. And
yeah.
So I really had a tough time at college. But while I was there, I was playing in a straight up 60s kind of punk band. We did a little bit, it had a little bit of sort of.
Is that Shithouse?
No. Shithouse was the industrial one.
Yeah.
The 60s punk one I played bass in, it was a little bit of kind of other things in there as well. Like, you know, we did a Gun Club cover. And
okay.
That was, for a short while, it was called Pussy Galore, and then most of the time it was called The Philistones. So I was playing bass in that band and also played percussion in Shithouse, which was the kind of art, terror, noise group.
We would
play sometimes, Shithouse would play sometimes hardcore shows, we'd be on bills, you know, we'd even put on our own shows. You know, got to be friends with the local, some of the local Providence bands.
Who were some of the local ones at the time? Do you remember?
There was a group called Stupid Questions, I think.
Okay.
There was... I can't remember. Not a lot I could of bands just that kind recorded. Of remember flyers that I made, you know.
Did you guys record either of these bands?
No. I mean, you know, in the practice space, yeah. in wherever we practiced. No, Shithouse did a radio session in some place in Rhode Island State somewhere, and so that was sort of, you know, more professionally recorded.
Yeah.
You know, Shithouse would, in addition to playing on hardcore bills, we would do things like, you know, we'd stage kind of happenings. There was a railroad tunnel that went underneath the hill, an old disused railroad tunnel that went underneath the hill that Brown and RISD were on.
Yeah.
And so you could walk through it, and it was a long, dark tunnel. So we did a kind of performance happening where, you know, we played in one end of the tunnel, and there was all sorts of fire, and so I was somewhere in the middle of the tunnel, slowly making my way up towards where the rest of the group in the audience was, bent with a, you know, was beating on the old rail,
like the rail lines,
yeah,
I guess. Or,
yeah. Wow. Yeah. So we would do stuff like that. Anyway, so I got to know Julie. Julie was at Brown and RISD. There was, you know, it wasn't a huge group of punk rockers or whatever you want to call it, but so, you know, there was this mix of kind of arty yeah. types and. What
a, so it's codified, too, yeah. at that point.
So she and I weren't having the best time of our life at Brown, and so it really seemed kind of on a whim that I said, well, let's just stop going and or take a break. So we moved to D.C. and started Pussy Galore.
Why D.C., though? Like,
she was from D.C.
Oh, that's why. Okay, I was going to say. Like,
and I was just like, at the point, I was like, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, cause especially because you're like, hardcore's not, didn't really catch you. It seems like that would be, at that point.
I think hardcore was also, you know, the thing for me was that it was, you know, you'd talk to some people and you'd read these magazines and stuff and fanzines, and just the rules seemed like, I didn't understand.
Yeah.
Like, it was ridiculous, but it was, you know, it was also, I think, an aesthetic thing for me. Don't get me wrong, there are some bands that I did really like, there are some records I really did like, but Julie was not really a close friend, so it was really this sort of, you know, yeah, sure, okay, let's do it. I think we both spent a summer living in Providence, and at that point, it was just like, this is the worst. Anything would be better. So we left and started, we went to D.C. and started Pussy Galore. And the reason we went to D.C. is because that's where Julie was from. And I don't know if she suggested it. You'd have to ask Julie.
Yeah.
But that's where I went and lived there. We only lived there for about a year maybe, and then moved to New York City. And while Pussy Galore was there, when we started, we... you know, we recorded two records and I think we put out one and then put out the second EP just right when we moved to New York.
Oh, really? Bob Burt doesn't play on the second one?
No.
Oh, well, that's right. Okay.
No. Bob didn't join until
the third
Pussy Gold 5000.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's right. And Bob came in because our drummer, John Hamill, didn't want to leave DC. He stayed. Yeah.
So when you...
And at first, Neil wasn't going to come either. Neil Haggerty was stayed. And then once Julie and I got to New York, and we had this terrible sublet on, I think it was on Mott Street, and we're like two blocks from CBGB's. And when we went down to New York, or went to New York to look for an apartment, I think we took this place with no idea that CB's was
exactly.
right there.
Yeah.
So we all, Julie and her boyfriend and me and Christina, we all lived in this terrible small place. And I remember that one of the bedrooms was painted all black. And it was a hot, terribly, terribly hot summer. And then soon enough, Neil showed up. And I think Neil may have had brought Jennifer as well. So it was may have been six of us all crammed into this one terrible apartment sublet
on the Lower East Side of New York City.
Yeah.
Back when you were in DC, did you go? Were you like, okay, we're gonna form Pussy Galore when we get there. We're gonna do that, or was that just like you got there and you're like, let's start this band?
I think that the idea was I can't really remember, but I think the idea was to stop going to school and start a band.
Yeah,
I think so.
So who were some of the bands that you guys would have played with
in DC?
Yeah. That you would have fit in, because I like listening. I
half Japanese.
Yeah, you know? I guess that would be. I was gonna say like Obsessed. I could hear it because of the dirgy elements, but
no,
maybe not.
No, I wasn't really into the Discord stuff.
Yeah,
and then we kind of did that bratty thing where to kind of separate ourselves from them. You know, there were some people were very nice to us in D.C. and took us in. I think the people we were closest to was this other kind of industrial group called New Carrollton.
Okay.
And they were younger. I think that some of them were in high school. They seemed to be a bit younger. Just kind of a lot of noise and some metal percussion and. There was them, and then the other big one was Peach of Immortality,
okay,
which is led by Tom Smith, and that we kind of fell in with Tom, and that wasn't the best thing for us because Tom kind of ripped us off.
But not to get off topic of that thing, but with the bands that you guys were playing with at that point in DC, was there a sense that? Like you were going to build a scene there, or were you just like, this is dire and hopeless?
I don't recall that sense. I don't think so. No.
Because especially like I've always been fascinated by the outlier bands from that DC scene. Like the bands that didn't have the Discord stamp of approval or whatever, or want the Discord stamp of approval in the case of Pussy Galore.
Mm.
But it's always been like, there's a lot of interesting stuff that kind of happened on the fringes. And it's just always intriguing that it's not more interconnected. At that point, so you guys moved to New York, and mm-hmm. and that's when I guess the band really started getting going. Like, was there a following in DC when you left at all?
A small one, yeah. There were people there, some people there that liked us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we played around a little bit, and we even went on a short tour, maybe a couple week or 2 weeks. It was mostly through the Southeast. It was Pussy Galore and Peach of Immortality, and. So,
did you play New York on that tour?
No, it was okay. It was all kind of in the South and the Midwest, I believe. We were in much more into like what was happening musically and artistically in New York City, much more into New York City as a place and as a, you know, a real true proper big city. And
mm-hmm.
So we moved there. Hey, do you mind if I get
water? No, do you want another beer?
No, thanks.
Oh, sorry. No, I was going to pause it for a second.
Is it alright if I just grab it?
Please, yeah, I'm sorry, I was going to.
Don't worry, Toronto's not a Boyle City water thing. I'm sure you've been here enough to know that.
What's that?
I'm sure you've been to Toronto to know enough that you can drink the tap water.
Oh, okay.
That Montreal tap water tastes super gross.
Awesome. So I think that, you know, I can't really remember, but I think as far as Pussy Galore, like we wanted to be accepted by, you know, we really looked up to The Fall.
Yeah.
We really looked up to Sonic Youth or something. We wanted to be accepted by those people, and those are people which were a bit older than us, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was our idea to, like, you know, we're gonna make a scene and gather these, you know, other people around us. You know, Pussy Galore was also a lot about just super bratty and super negative, and so we weren't about building anything or fostering much of anything, you know. But as you know, we lasted for about 5 years, and we did tour, and as we started to travel around, we did begin to meet people,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that was an incredible eye opener for me to go to Ohio, to go to Chicago, to go to Minneapolis, and meet meet the Gibson Brothers, meet Big mm-hmm. Black, meet Killdozer, just start meeting all these bands, and it wasn't just about, seeing new places, seeing the cities, but discovering this whole kind of network and like that there were so many other people out there making cool. I was reading fanzines, I was buying records,
yeah.
So it wasn't like I was a total idiot in a vacuum, I'd heard about Big Black, I'd heard about Killdozer, I own those records, or some of them.
But seeing how big it is when you get there and
yeah,
all these
but
other
it was,
bands.
You know, it was great, it was a really great, very, very healthy, great time, to be traveling around and making.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Friends.
Do you think the scenes had more of a local flavor at that point, like compared to now, or do you think there's still like that kind of like regional identity?
I think that's never going to go away. I mean, yeah, that the you know the internet's sort of a great eraser
leveler
or kind of sandpaper, yeah. But I think that you know things are always going to you know that regionality, if that's a word, is always going to be there. Definitely, then there seemed to be. You know, maybe a little bit more of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it definitely seems like, you know, like well, yourselves and Sonic Youth in New York versus the bands in Chicago versus, like, not versus as in pit against each other, but I mean just stylistically, it's kind of like different feels to versus the stuff happening in Detroit
mm-hmm.
or the Touch and Go and things like that at that mm-hmm. point. So you guys tour with Pussy Galore, and then I guess it kind of. What, did it get to a point where you're like, this is a viable band, or did you always kind of feel?
I mean, I think it was just again, like you know, I've always been very focused, and so this was like, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I put everything into that band, and I never thought that I'm gonna have a number one record. I wasn't that stupid, you know. With the kind of music we were making, It was you know, and we were doing exactly what we wanted to be doing, willfully so. And it was very kind of aggressive and very hate filled and very harsh music. I was not deluding myself in any way.
Yeah.
But it was like this is what I want to be doing, and you know, I was if we could go out and play for 20 people somewhere, that was great. You know. And you know, derived immense satisfaction from you know putting a record out, and we did pretty well when we moved to New York City. People seemed to like us, you know, and so that helped. But I wasn't ever really thinking. I don't think so. That you know, this is a career.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be able to, you know, make a lot of money doing this, or you know, I never have. That's never. I can never understand when I. Talk to somebody or read an interview with some bands or they're when they talk about careers or strategies or you know it seems totally foreign.
Well, you know, like obviously maybe not career aspiration were the focus, but I think Pussy Galore is definitely a band that influenced, like obviously every band you've done has influenced different people in different ways, but like that level of hate I guess in that, you know, it really connected with me as a younger person. And, you know, I think I would definitely credit that with a lot of influence on some of my other bands as well. Like, it's a band that, you know, carried on. But eventually it comes to an end.
Yeah, it's hard to maintain that.
You yeah.
know, if you're doing something that is that poisonous. You know, and so I think that there, you know, the emotionally, you know, it's just like, ooh, it's tough to keep that going. And I think that stylistically or aesthetically, we kind of made the point. We've mm-hmm. done it. Also, Julie and I weren't really getting along so well after a few years. So it you know, so that was it. You know, we did 5 years, and that was the end. That was it.
And then, so at this point, you relocate to Columbus?
No, I never lived in Columbus.
Oh, you never actually lived?
No, I got to be good friends with the... Jeff Evans and Don Hallen from the Gibson Brothers.
Did you play with them?
I did for a little bit. Yeah, they. I did play with them for a little while. I was kind of their substitute or fill-in rhythm guitar player. I love that band, the Gibson Brothers.
Yeah,
I did spend a little bit of time with them, but no, I never. At various times, Christine and I had thought about you know like well maybe we should move somewhere and maybe we spent a week in Memphis or we went out and looked around at Chicago and then but it's just.
We never
did it. And we always stayed in New York City.
Yeah, I imagine Columbus, Ohio also would be it'd be a little bit like going back to Providence in a way. To
mm-hmm.
you know, so I guess you move John, I guess John Spencer's Blues Explosion is the next thing you do musically, band-wise? Do you have an...
There was about a year in between Pussy Galore and the Blues Explosion. During that time, I was kicking around a little bit with the Gibson Brothers.
Yeah.
Also, all during this time, Boss Hog is going.
Oh, Boss Hog, too, of
Boss
course.
Boss Hog started in, I don't know, 87 or 88. So it overlaps.
Yeah, everything.
Pussy Galore and the Blues Explosion. So there was that, and I was kind of doing this and that. And I think that the Blues Explosion was, you know, not a planned thing. It was, I kind of met Jude and Russell by accident and just started, and we tried playing together.
Yeah, Honeymoon Killers too, I guess, right?
Yeah. So Jude, Russell, and I each served a bit of time with the Honeymoon Killers, as did Christina. She was the Honeymoon Killers. I was doing different things, and I think that that the big shift is for me in some ways is that kind of coming to or coming to terms with or getting to be being at peace with rock and roll or certain aspects of it. I began to, you know, not feel so bothered by it, you know, and felt that I could in some way embrace parts of it and hold parts of it dear. Because some of what Pussy Galore was about was sort of, you know, anti-rock and roll.
Yeah.
And it was sort of about how this was, you know, the band in some ways was about how the frustration with, you know, not just rock and roll, but kind of so many other things, you know, but rock and roll was in there, youth culture was in there, and, you know, that this was a sort of dead, corrupt, and totally co-opted in used-up language. And, I think I kind of worked through that, and when the Blues Explosion started, I was, you know, obsessed with Sun Records and people like Jerry Lee Lewis, and I think part of it is also, you know, growing up a little bit and getting a little older.
I can't believe I glossed over Boss Hog, because I actually, that was that's where I first kind of got introduced to you from, too, was Boss Hog, because I Dig You was kind of like one of the first videos that I fell in love with as a kid getting into...
How old are you?
35.
Okay.
So it would have been 13, 14.
So when you were listening to Pussy Galore, how old were you?
Oh, like my 20s.
Oh, okay.
I'm like, not as it came out, but yeah. I definitely was as we've well established, you and me today, I'm a bit of a record nerd.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of going to record stores and buying used records and stuff like that. Still didn't need the first 12-inch, but, you know, I'm working on that. So Boss Hog forms in 87, but you guys signed to a major label at some point, right?
We did, like, after the whole Nirvana kerfuffle.
Yeah.
Yeah, we took advantage of that. But Blues Explosion was, you know, Blues Explosion, we always did what we wanted to do, exactly what we wanted to do. And we've always been, and it's still the same to this day. And, you know, when Nirvana thing happened, we had some people kind of sniffing around, but I never really, you know, it wasn't... I certainly never took any meetings or serious ones, or, you know, there wasn't a lot of wooing going on, because I didn't really want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be able to continue to make whatever kind of record we wanted to make.
Yeah.
And this is going back to, you know, the lessons from Providence, Rhode Island was, you know, hardcore was just like, well, yeah, go ahead, do it.
Yeah.
Boss Hog was different, and, you know, it's a band that Christine and I started together, but I guess it's always sort of been a little bit more Christina's band, and she was okay with the idea of doing the deal with Geffen, and, you know, all of us were in the band at the time, Jens and Hans as well, the four of us, and I think what helped the situation was that our A&R person was an old friend of ours from New York City,
mm-hmm.
A woman named Jody Carilla, and she used to book the Pyramid Club. So this was somebody we'd known for years, and...
Did she write that book?
No.
So
we felt safe,
you
know, with her. It was a weird time, though. Nirvana was not really my cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I certainly do think that whole thing, you know, it ruined the scene.
It ruined the... So what was it like... Because it's funny, because it...
Even though, you know, but who am I to... complain, because Boss Hog signed together.
Yeah,
you know, I we enjoyed some slice of the pie.
Did you see them being that band that would break through? Because I talked to Jay, and Jay's like, they sound like Bad Company. Like, it sounded like a band that was going to get popular.
It sounded like Bad I don't know. I shouldn't say bad. No, but, like rock. You know,
yeah,
like
it's not for
it
you.
It was not rock and roll. Has never really been, you know, that or most of it. It's not really my thing, you know, or what people like to call rock. It was 70s rock.
Yeah.
You know, and that shit is like, it always just like flips me out. People talk about like, oh, this great new stuff. Like, you know, there's so many bands I could name and like, wow, this is so new and progressive and stuff. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is, it sounds exactly like the shit that was on the radio when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It sound, it's here it is, Led Zeppelin all over again.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's popular? It's the same shit, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wasn't really my bag. You know, I knew Sub Pop. I knew Bruce and Jonathan. You know, Pussy Galore had been out when we went out to the West Coast the first time. I think it was the first time. I think it may have been to the photographer Michael Levine that we knew. We got to know Bruce and Jonathan because he had connections with Sub Pop. I can't remember exactly, but we knew those bands. And so when we went out there, we were paired up with Tad.
Yeah.
We thought it was going to be, I don't know who we thought it was going to be. If we're angling for one band, and then Bruce or Jonathan or both of them said, no, we're going to put you with Tad. And Tad was the new sign. So we did this tour together in the West Coast with Pussy Galore and Tad. I knew. I was getting the singles. I was getting the records. I was, you know, I was. Did I think they were going to break or become big? No. Would I have thought that? No. Was I even? It just wasn't something I would think about. You know.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do. Didn't fit into the equation. It didn't compute in any way. You know. It's never been like, oh, what's going to be big? What's going to be popular? You know. I'm not really. That's not my thing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So with John Spencer Blues Explosion, though, did you get that name from John Spencer Louts? John Spencer and the Louts?
No.
Okay. Do you have ever seen that 7-inch? There's like this old bar rock 7-inch, John Spencer's Louts.
There's a Dutch John Spencer. It's J-O-H-N.
J-O-H-N, too.
Yeah, and I do have that John. I actually have a copy of the Louts.
Okay, I was going to bring that for you.
Yeah, no, I got that one, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. No, it's not from there. No.
Okay. I post that and I had to ask. So when you moved to New York, with you guys signed to Matador, you
earned the Red right first, away. Right? And what's that?
What John Spencer?
The Blues Explosion started in '91.
Yeah, but what label did you put out the first stuff?
Well, the first record is a bootleg, which was on Pubic Pop Can, which was the Silbury's label,
okay.
Basically. And then we did one record with Caroline. And Caroline was, I had a relationship with Pussy Galore.
Yeah.
And then after that record came out, the guy, you could relate to this, perhaps, I had a meeting with the then head of the label, which was a guy named Keith Wood, English guy, nice enough guy, but he took me out to lunch and said, like, well, you know, I don't care what he said, but he was trying to politely suggest that maybe I should do a solo record and, you know, something different. You know,
yeah.
they weren't happy with the way that things had gone with the first record. And it's not like Pussy Galore. I think, you know, what did Pussy Galore sell? 10,000 records or something? You know, there was some modicum of...
Big, respectable numbers today, definitely.
Yeah. So that first Blues Explosion record is pretty, you know, kind of spiky and a bit angular, you know, and it was a lot of ideas and a rush of energy. They weren't so happy with the way things had went, and he was suggesting that I work with some other people, and so that was the end of it with Caroline, and
An interesting roster they had at that point, too, with you guys, with Unrest, with Youth of Today, with Bad Brains, I think, were
at for a while. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Stuff.
I work with Caroline for a few years, and it wasn't bad. I mean, there was the big thing that was stuck in my craw was the amount of money they were shoveling into the White Zombie at the time.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that was, you know, like we talked about, that was somebody who I knew Rob a little bit.
Yeah,
Rob and Sean.
Would Pussy of Blur played with White Zombie when they first came to New York?
And once to New York, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Julie's boyfriend at the time, Rick, was a big White Zombie fan.
Okay.
And White Zombie's not really, was never really my bag, but Rob and Sean were nice people. We definitely hung out a bit, and they were pals with Gerard, so I knew those people, and it was just bizarre to see where, you know, what happened, you know.
Yeah. And also, like, it took a long time for them to really blow up, right? Like, it wasn't until More Human Than a Human a few years later that it really took off for Rob Zombie. We had to play after him one time on a festival in Australia, like a touring festival, and he would have audio-visual problems every show. And so it would always be like, it would go us, then I think the Bronx. Oh, no, it would go them, White Zombie, then the Bronx, then the Melvins, then us to back clean up on the stage when everyone else was watching headliners. And so they would go, the stage manager would go to every band and be like, okay, you got to cut your set. You got to cut your set. And every band would be like, fuck you, we're not doing it. Fuck you, we're not doing it. And then we'd get to us and we'd be the last band. So
you guys got the...
Oh, but it was awesome. It's amazing. They pay you the same. You get to play 15 minutes. Yeah. So it's like, it all equals out, right? At a festival. So where do you go from... where do you go from there as far as signing to Matador, I guess, is the next?
I can't remember how exactly we signed to Matador. I knew those people.
Would you have known Gerard back in going to the hardcore shows in Boston?
No. I didn't know. I wasn't that aggressive about the hardcore stuff.
Yeah.
I met Gerard when we moved to New York City, and got to be good friends with him, and spent, you know, like it was said, we used to borrow Julie's VW Rabbit and go out to White Castle, and... I was a big fan of Conflict, and you know, I had most of the Homestead catalog. Yeah. You know, I knew, you know, who this guy was, and then got to be friends with him, and
had you already left Homestead by the time you got to be friends with him, or
I think
Matador was 91, I think it starts, right?
Yeah, but I mean, Chris started Matador, didn't he?
Dust Devil and Railroad.
So I knew, I think I met Chris, so I moved to New York City in 86, I think. And met Gerard almost right away.
Okay.
Probably may have met him or kind of got to know him when he interviewed Pussy Galore for Conflict.
Okay.
Maybe not. I don't know. But got to be good friends with him. And then later, and towards the end of that decade, got to be friends with a guy named Charlie Andrus, who was the drummer for The Unsane. Mm-hmm. And he became drummer for Boss Hogg. And he was pals, I think, with Chris Lombardi. And then that's how I got introduced to Chris. So I met Chris and got to know Matador before Gerard became a part of it.
86, he was still with Homestead, definitely. Yeah. So what led you to that label at that point? Was Johan Kugelberg the A&R guy at that point? Or no?
Are you a fan of Mr. Kugelberg's?
I'm a fan of Kill by Death Records. He's a character that lives in...
Johan was kind of around. Crypt Records I'm a huge fan of Crypt Records, and so Tim Warren, you know, kind of be sometimes living nearby, sometimes passing through, and Johan was sort of in Tim's circle.
Yeah.
You know, there were sort of these, you know, you'd have these overlaps between, say, Homestead or Matador and Crypt and, you know, some of these people. And so, no, Johan did not sign.
Okay.
It would have been either Chris or Gerard.
Yeah.
You know, I knew both those guys. I knew Marco. I knew Jesper. I knew these. You know, I knew Rusty. I knew those people.
Yeah,
there were, you know, got people I've been seeing around at shows and been like, you know, spent hours just, you know, talking shit with at, you know, out front on the sidewalk of the show or, you know, wherever at a bar or, you know, these were my friends. And so how the deal exactly was done, I can't recall. But the Caroline thing was not so great for us, and we weren't under contract to Caroline. At least I don't think so. We were certainly free to go. So we made extra width, and we did that with Matador.
So, and was it immediately the response? Or were you even seeing a response locally before the record came out?
No, I think it took us a while for people to kind of figure out. You know, I think especially at the beginning, the first couple of years of Blue Explosion, you know, we were willfully really fucking with people. You know, we'd do shows where Russell wouldn't play drums. Where Russell and Judah would play guitar and I would just sing. A lot of our early songs, you know, are just very short, just kind of like a burst of idea. You know, and I think as over the first 2 or 3 years, there was an incredible, you know, growth. And, you know, it's just kind of us figuring out like, okay, this works or that works. That doesn't work so good. And also, you know, getting into certain kinds of music and certain kind of records and touring, playing shows. We just started to play out as much as we could. Locally and on the road, we, I don't know why, but we got invited to support Buffalo Tom. We went out and did that. Then we did a lot of stuff with the Jesus Lizard. Yeah. And that was a really big thing for us because we were great fans of the Jesus Lizard. And they were such nice people and it was such good company. There were great shows to be at, you know. Mm-hmm. And also we learned a lot from them, you know, like these are the guys who are, they're, you know, they're very dedicated, very hardworking, you know, and making great art, and great music. And that was a big thing for us. We did, we supported the Breeders. We did a lot of stuff and then we just started playing on our own. And I think it was just touring, just playing around, traveling around. We certainly weren't, you know, it wasn't at, you know, things are kind of changing, you know, and so it's the underground is quite different from the late 80s and Pussy mm-hmm. Galore. Now there's like, you know, there's money in the hills, you know, and so there was, you know, you could maybe get in People magazine or you could get on 120 minutes or maybe you get booked on Letterman or something or other, or, you know, there were, you know, stuff was possible.
Boss Hogg was in Joe's apartment.
Yeah, we were in Joe's apartment, yeah.
Don't laugh that off. That was that's a pretty awesome movie in retrospect. You know, a lot better than the stuff that's coming out now.
But we didn't wait around for anything. We just went out and played. I think that's how we got out there. We won people over at the shows.
Did you ever feel like? Because it seems like you never really were in a band that played to a scene. Or like went like towards a scene. Did you ever feel like with John Spencer there was a scene that you felt a part of?
Pussy Galore, I felt more part of the scene. But okay. The scene was, you know, the underground, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Indie rock. You know, there was Sonic Youth. There was Black Flag. Big Black. There were the Melvins. There was Mudhoney. There were all the, you know, there was Touch and Go, there was Sub Pop, there was all these labels, you know, there was Homestead. That Pussy Galore, where musically or sonically or whatever, you know, maybe we weren't in bed together with some of these people, but there was, I've really felt, yeah, connected as part of a movement or something that was going on, you know. It was a very exciting time. Blues Explosion always just felt like we were kind of, you know, on our own. And I think at that time, you know, there were a lot of bands. You'd go see a band and the people would be like looking at their feet. And it's like, what do you want to be playing the show? Or do you want to be here? And so we were always, you know, we had no problem with putting on a show. We were pro show, you know, we're for show business.
Well, I've seen you play tons of shows over the years. And I've never seen you have an off night. Do you have these? Because definitely have off nights too.
Yeah. In Burlington, just 2 nights ago, we were home for a week, and then we started up again another leg of the, you know, we're basically touring to the end of the year. Yeah. So we'll go out for 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Be home for maybe a week or 10 days in between every little chunk. And so this was the first show after a week off, and it was a little rough. We played everything way too fast. I broke a string, which hardly ever happens. Russell broke 2 kick drum pedals, you know, and so things like that, just like poof.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can recover, and sometimes you can't. Also, my parents came to see the show because it was in Vermont, and even though I'm 50 years old and been doing this for 30 years, I still get nervous. You know, I'm still very much aware, like, oh, my folks are here.
Yeah.
You know, but my parents, God bless them, have always been very supportive of, you know, any kind of artistic endeavor that I've gotten into. And it should be, I would like to note that the Blues Club, we don't use a set list. So
yeah,
it's, you know, we're always kind of, sometimes it can work to our great advantage to have that room for chance. And sometimes you can really just, you know, stumble and trip and fall. And it can be very hard to recover a momentum. But I've also done it long enough where I'm aware that, like, whereas for me, I might be thinking, this is the worst thing ever. For someone in the audience, they might not catch that at all. It's also become much easier for me over the years not to totally kill myself after a show. Yeah. You know, but then that's taken like 30 years. You know, I used to just really agonize over mistakes, you know, and things which only I was aware of.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to get past that point. I'm really looking forward to that because I'm still able to beat myself up over it for the rest of the evening. Not to backtrack, but I wanted to, you know, go back to the scene in New York. Did you ever feel part of the cinema transgression stuff was played into the scene that you were talking about?
Well,
there?
I mean, I was into people like
Tessa
Hughes Freeland. Yeah. I was into Richard Kern. I was into Nick Zed. I was into, you know.
Were you still making films at this point? Or
no, that was more when I was at Brown.
Okay.
You know, that's why I was interested in making movies, and that's what I tried to do, and I did make some, and some of those people were nice and let me show films, you know, as part of their, you know, programs that are put in on the Cinema Transgression. I don't know how much of a real thing that was. I think it was just something that Nick Zed made up.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were kind of accommodating and included me in some of this stuff. You know, but it was a weird time. I was like 19 years old, 18, 19 years old. I'd call up Dan Satiri and say like, yeah, I have these movies. I was wondering if I could come show them. Okay. You know, we're going to put you on this floor. You're going to be there at 2 a.m. You're going to show your movies. How do you want to be billed? We're going to pay this much money. You know,
so it's kind of like Nirvana, but like 90s Tarantino, Nirvana, like this whole kind of like indie move to the big screen, big stage, I guess, killed a lot of that sort of stuff. Like the idea of just calling up a club and getting yourself a show. A lot of it's now a booking agent.
Yeah.
I guess it was probably.
It's business. It's money.
Yeah. Well, you have to play a show.
What time is it?
What? 9 o'clock.
So you got
to get there. But can I ask you just a couple,
lightning round? Yeah,
lightning round about a couple.
James Maskus, lightning round.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, then you will stay in here quietly for 20 minutes while I ask you questions. What was it like working with the following people? Dan the Automator, who also worked with Spaz, the hardcore band.
Okay.
Weirdly,
I didn't know that, or maybe I forgot. Dan, we worked with Dan because mainly because of Blue Flowers by you know, the whole Dr. Octagon. Working with Dan, it was good. You know, I think he did a couple really great things for us. I was going to say he did one great song, Talk About the Blues, but that's not true. There's a few really great things he did. It's Dan, I think, is he's not someone I ever really kind of clicked with in a personal way. Mm-hmm. So working with him is, while we've had some good results, it's not always been the most satisfying thing for me.
An artist that we worked with as well, the GZA. Did you work with the GZA at all, like closely?
When we were doing, you know, that's from the remix. I had one phone conversation with him, and he remixed a song off of Orange for the experimental. This was for the experimental remix record, and that was when a lot of the songs on that record were things. Once I got the remixes back, I spent quite a bit of time kind of tweaking and re-editing things I thought, you know, that the results were a little lackluster. Fuck them, it's my record anyway. Yeah. So that a lot of people talk about, you know, there's this one guy I know, producer and mixer, who will talk about how that GZA remix is like his favorite thing ever, and all the stuff that he cites is like his favorite thing ever. The things that I did, you know, so that it was
a collaboration.
Yes, that's fair to say. Totally fair. I mean, the thing is that, you know, there's sometimes you do these things, it's just kind of, you find out like, this is disappointing. This person doesn't give a fuck, or this person just did it for the, you know, the little bit of chain, the money, or, you know, you can really tell. It's like there's not, you know, you can tell when somebody is truly invested and truly interested in their hearts in it. And the other thing that always bothered my mind is that, you know, I love Russell. He's such a great drummer.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you want to sample
his drums?
Some of those beats.
Yeah. I you know, once again, not to keep you two more, Weird Al.
Well, the best answer for that is, what it's like working with Weird Al? Weird.
And I guess finally, Chain Gang, you cover Son of Sam.
Yeah.
And I guess they would have been kind of around New York for that.
I mean, I saw them, I didn't see them back in the day.
Yeah.
I saw them around the Mondo Manhattan.
Yeah, the Mondo Manhattan.
And that's when I think that was, I don't know, it was a Lombardi thing. I think Lombardi was tight with Ricky, or I don't know which one.
He passed away like last year.
That was one of the whole, you know, I think I heard that from, if it was not from Killed by Death, it was from the Tim Warren, fuck you, Johan Kugelberg, Fiolunky Punk, which is probably the better comp.
Yeah, I mean, but then he did a second diss record to him after that, where he took his entire want list and put out a Kill by Death of just his want list.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's the follow up. These are like the legendary beasts of the Kill by Death world. All right, yeah. Well, John, I could talk to you all night, but you got to play a show. Thank you so much for making this a reality. Thank you.
You're welcome.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.